The following is a recording for Rebecca Cheeky with the American Hospital Association of Chicago on Tuesday, December 13th, 2016 at 2 o'clock p.m. Central Time. Excuse me, ladies and gentlemen. Participation in this call is by express written invitation of the AHA only. Unauthorized participants and or any party that aids and abets such unauthorized participants may be subject to criminal and civil penalties under both state and federal law. Please disconnect from the call if the AHA did not expressly invite your participation. It is now my pleasure to turn the conference over to Ms. Rebecca Cheeky. Pam, you may begin.
Thank you, operator, and welcome, everyone, for today's call, Morrison County's Success in Combating Prescription Drug Abuse, CHI St. Gabriel Health's experience, and they are located in Little Falls, Minnesota. This is one of several webinars and conference calls that the American Hospital Association has offered as part of an executive dialogue series on how hospitals and healthcare systems are working to impact and reduce the impact of the opiate crisis. Let me do just a couple of housekeeping items before I turn the call over to the speakers. First of all, as the director of AHA's Section for Psychiatric and Substance Abuse Services, I welcome you again all today to today's call. I encourage you, as you are listening to the presentation, to think about questions that you can ask these incredibly experienced and inspirational speakers. The operator at the end of the presentation will be giving you instructions on how to queue up to answer to ask a question via the phone. Or you can send a question to me at rchickey, that's R-C-H-I-C-K-E-Y, at aha.org. One clarification, I will let you know that the presentation itself is being recorded, but the Q&A session will not be at this time. And finally, if any of you have had difficulty accessing or forgot to download or access the PowerPoint presentation, it is available online at the section's website. Go to www.aha.org/psych, that's P-S-Y-C-H, then click on the name, the title of today's conference call, and it will take you to its homepage where you will find the speaker bios for two of our three speakers today. You'll find the bio there for Dr. Heather Bell, as well as for Dr. Kurt Devine, as well as you will find the PowerPoint. So now let me formally introduce the three speakers. Today, starting off the presentation, will be Rhonda Buckaloo. She is the administrator of the Family Medical Center for CHI St. Gabriel's Health. Joining her today are Dr. Heather Bell, who began her family medicine practice in rural Minnesota. And as you will learn, she has become very active in the controlled substance care team within the clinic setting and has recently introduced medication-assisted addiction treatment using Suboxone as part of her family primary care practice. Joining her as well is Dr. Kurt Devine. He has been a full spectrum of family medicine physician for more than 26 years. And as a practicing physician in rural Minnesota, has faced many unique challenges as caring for patients in the primary care setting amid the many evolving care delivery models demanded forward-thinking and creative strategies for change. It is through his exemplary leadership that a small rural clinic has made significant progress related to opioid use in a small rural community. There's more information on each of the speakers, as I noted earlier, but I wanted to give you a sense for the quality and caliber of the individuals to whom you are now going to listen. And Rhonda, with that, I turn the call over to you.
Thanks, Rebecca, and thank you for inviting us to share a little bit of our story here today. We're quite honored and humbled that others would like to hear about the good work that we're doing here in our community. So just to start us off, give you a little background about who we are. St. Gabriel's Health, we are part of a critical access hospital, and Family Medical Center is our is actually the clinic in our small community of about 8,000 people in our small community with, and of course, our county population of between 10 and 12,000. We consider ourselves just a primary care general specialty clinic with family medicine, internal meds, general surgery, and behavioral health, which we have adopted as part of our patient-centered medical home as part of our primary care practice. In addition, we also are part of St. Gabriel's Health, which is a system of course, the Crooked Rock Hospital. We have a sister clinic. We also have a home care and hospice division and a long-term extended care facility, St. Camilla's Place. So what we're here to talk to you today is our comprehensive community model, which came together in efforts to address the opioid use in our communities a number of years ago. In 2015, we were the lucky recipients of a SIM grant, which allowed us to collaborate with some of our community partners to rethink our approach to combating opioid use and abuse in our community with the help of our partner, South Country Health Alliance, who was our payer for our Medicaid population in our community, our patient-centered medical home clinic, of course, that we're referencing here in our conversation today, Family Medical Center. And, of course, other things are happening in our community, such as the Stand Up For You Coalition, which addresses preventative health and preventative measures for drug and alcohol abuse for our youth in our community, and also our Prescription Drug Task Force, which has grown over the last couple of years to become very inclusive of a lot of community members, including pharmacies, public health, social services, and also our police and law enforcement. Slide four, just a quick summary of our community partners, and I will skip along to slide five. So how we got to where we're at, like many communities, back in 2010, we started to try to figure out what it is we could do to address the opioid problem within our community, and we did a little bit with law enforcement and pulled together the beginnings of a task force, started utilizing the Minnesota's PMP, or Physicians Monitoring Program for prescriptions, and then we started developing clinic medication contracts. But like many clinics and many practices, the concerns were ongoing. We didn't really have a real formal process nor a culture in the clinic to adopt things that would change prescribing patterns and patient expectations. So we continued to see emergency department visits for refills of medicine. We had law enforcement and community concerns continuing to escalate. We had inconsistencies for use of and watching the monitoring program by our physicians and our prescribers. And the clinic was getting tired and putting in a lot of efforts around early refill requests and demanding patients and the need for opioids in our practice setting. So we knew we needed to do something. So in 2015, we sat down with our community partners, and we were the recipients of a SIM grant, which allowed us to think of our new model and approach this a little bit differently. So we secured the State Innovation Model Grant. We collaborated with our Drug-Free Communities Grant, and we pulled together a newly formed Community Prescription Drug Task Force. And in addition, we created a controlled substance care team within the clinic setting. Both of which, the task force and the clinic controlled substance care team, the provider champion, a little piece for that that helped us really look at and examine how we operate in the clinic and what our standard protocols and processes for delivering our care, and also proved to be a nice partner and build the partnerships within the community. So at the center and the foundation of all what we've done, when we started this work back in the early part of 2015, we wrote a mission statement, and that mission statement is on slide seven. And though we have changed and developed what we do along the way, we've kind of kept this mission statement at our core, meaning that we are committed to collaborating with our partners, treating our patients with respect and kindness and dignity, and using the resources of our community wisely in delivering the care that we do for this population of our patients. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Kurt Devine. He's going to talk to you a little bit about the clinic controlled substance care team, which was formed in late spring of 2015. Early on, we spent a lot of time developing standard workflows and looking at ways prescribers were prescribing meds within their practice, and then eventually that transformed into more case reviews and care management. So I will turn this over to Dr. Devine, who will explain all the good work that we're doing.
Thanks. Let me just start by saying that when we sat down with this program and looking at how we're going to do this program, there's really, if you literature search, you really can't find really any guidelines for how to do something like this, and we actually did that. So we really sat down and looked at what our goal really was, and that was really, number one, we needed to get the patients that are on chronic narcotics and actually needed narcotics, we needed to get them on a dose that was the minimal effective dose. Number two, we needed to find those patients who were using our medications inappropriately and potentially mixing them with other drugs. And number three, we needed to be able to tell whether or not patients were selling our drugs. And a lot of that involved very aggressive monitoring, as well as our connections with our local law enforcement, who are really a treasure trove of information. So what we decided is that we went and we took our medical record, and we were able to search, and we were able to tell how many patients we had that were on chronic pain medications. And we started with a number in the mid-500s for our group, and which I think was surprising for all of us that it was that many people. But we realized that somehow we were going to have to take each of these people and go through one patient at a time. And although I've said this, we thought this would be a very quick thing. We thought that we'd be able to get through these patients in 6 months. At least that was my initial thought. And unfortunately, it's taken us almost a year and a half to get through half of the patients. And so it's a very slow-moving project. We knew that we needed to have information on patients when they came into our program, and so we knew that with the nurse that we had hired, the RN that we had hired, that we were going to need to have her meet with these patients and probably do that in conjunction with a social worker. And so, in fact, early on in our program, we drew a social worker into our program. And part of what we wanted them to do was get all the information available on this patient from the time that we brought them into our program, including what their pain history was and what their reason for being on pain medications was, what their treatments in the past had been, and whether or not they'd gone through treatment before, whether they'd been convicted of previous crimes with narcotics or selling drugs, and family history as well as social history, and get a full picture of what these patients were like. And that was really something that together that our nurse and our social worker would be able to do and put this into basically a form that then we'd be able to review when we sat down at our weekly meetings. I think that, you know, the one thing that's changed over the last 6 months is we now actually have a form that we use for that we're able to ask all those questions, put everything in there so that when everybody gets together, we have a very nice form to kind of go through on each patient and then use that form to give our doctors recommendations on the patients that we reviewed. As well, when we would see these patients, we would have our pharmacist, and we were fortunate to have a pharmacist that was actually a in their residency working with our program and still do through one of our local pharmacies who helps us with this project. And they would, of course, review the medications that the patient was on, look at any potential side effects or problems, figure out what the morphine equivalent dosing was for these patients so that we had a real good starting point. Basically, after we had kind of formed the team and kind of figured out what we were doing, then we would bring these patients into the program basically one at a time. As we started to review these patients, a lot of the things that we noticed were that, number one, our physicians weren't doing a lot of things. And by that, I mean they were not doing care plans. And we changed it, actually. We call it a substance care plan. We do not call it a contract or a pain contract. We found that the doctors routinely were not doing any urine testing. They were frequently giving refills on medications early. Many times we had patients getting full prescription refills once a year that were probably not necessary. And so there were a lot of things that were just not closely being watched. And one of the other interesting things we found that as we started review patients is that many times we couldn't tell why the patients were on pain medications. And so as we went through this program and developed a team to kind of follow these patients, we started to notice certain trends in the clinic, and knew right away that this was going to take an enormous amount of work. As we started to bring these patients into our program, the other big thing that we noticed was, as we looked back in patients' charts, one of the biggest problems we had was the way that the physicians were actually interpreting the urine testing. And to be honest with you, it's still confusing. We had a pharmacist at that time who was very integral and really looking at these urine tests and actually made some very nice flow sheets for us so that the doctors actually could understand what these urine drug screens meant, and when we did confirmatories could help us know whether or not the patient actually had the correct medications in their urine. And I can tell you that it was confusing, it is confusing, and I think it's something that needs to, in every community and every clinic, needs to be looked at closely, that their physicians understand that, because it was something that we found that was an enormous problem in our clinic. So basically what we found is that there was everything that was going on in our clinic was quite inconsistent, and our job was to, number one, take this from the doctors and let our team manage these patients and help them with them. And I'll tell you early on that that's difficult. Most physicians don't want to give up the reins. You know, I'm a physician. I sometimes don't enjoy having somebody looking over my shoulder. But I think in this case, over time, we found that the physician started to appreciate the job that the team would do, especially when our nurse was there helping them collect urines for urine samples, helping them figure out what dosing the patient should be on, and helping them interpret their urine drug screens. And so that was something that changed over time as how our physicians actually perceived the team. It's in a kind of an interesting way where when we started this, and I think early on our success was much more obvious. We actually went to each nurse in the clinic early on, and we asked them for a list of the patients that they felt were the most problematic in our group. And the patients that were asking for refills early, the patients that seemed to be frequently under the influence when they were in the clinic, patients that were difficult or belligerent or abusive to our staff who were on chronic pain medications, we tended to hone in on those people early on. And as we brought them into the program, one of the things that we wanted to make sure that we weren't doing was making this a punitive thing. We knew that if patients that we found were failing urine drug screens or they were having other issues, we wanted to make sure that when they were brought into our program, if they did fail their urines, if they failed their pill counts, we had the social workers to help us get these patients the help that they needed, whether that would be treatment or counseling, mental health needs, and so on. And so it really is something that's kind of each patient is brought in, and we work with that patient as hard as we can to get them headed the right direction. Early on, the patients that we drew into the program, I would tell you the first 10 that we brought in were not doing the correct things, and they failed urine tests, and they failed all types of things and ended up being tapered off medications and referred to other types of treatment. Sometimes if they truly had pain issues, we referred them for either physical therapy, occupational therapy, and sometimes to pain clinics and other places that they might help them really using, you know, non-opioid type medications. So, you know, lots of things that we look at to try and avoid the narcotics that some of these patients really weren't very good at managing on their own. I'm trying to think if there's something else. Did there other things that you wanted to? Maybe I'll let Dr. Heather Bell talk for a minute about some of the other issues.
Well, the next steps that we had gone to the Atlanta Drug Summit and Heroin Conference last April, trying to learn more about what we could do here to make our program that much better. And the first thing we kind of realized and eventually embraced was the fact that a lot of these patients do have addictions and do have troubles, whether that be the opioids or the opioid problem has now become a heroin problem, and that we needed to then have the ability to take care of these patients as well. Because like Dr. Devine said, we didn't want to, you know, just fire people from our practice. We wanted to help them as well.
So we quickly got our Suboxone prescribing licenses and started treating patients with the addiction with Suboxone, which took on a whole other step with our controlled substance care team. So now we have our controlled substance care team that still goes through all the chronic narcotic prescriptions in our clinic, and every patient who has chronic prescriptions in our clinic does eventually get into the program. But then we have this other subset of patients who have the addiction problem. So what happens there is they call our clinic and, you know, inquire about the program, and then they talk with our nurse on the phone. Our primary RN for our controlled substance care team does an intake on their history with drugs and substances of abuse. One of us physicians then meets with the patient, usually with the social worker and the nurse if that's possible, to again hear their history, hear their story, where we then decide, are they, you know, are they eligible or are they appropriate for Suboxone treatment. Our social worker helps them get set up for Rule 25. If they don't already have a Rule 25 in place, help them get hooked up with inpatient or outpatient treatment if needed. And then if they're on meds and they need to be on Suboxone, we then get them started and do the Suboxone initiations right through our clinic. We've kind of taken another few steps with the Suboxone and made it easier for our prior auths to go through. But these patients, you know, they're a special group of patients. We see them multiple times a week, especially at the beginning. We do whatever we can to help them get into treatment. This group of patients is very challenging and manipulative. And so our nurse is frequently calling them to check on them, to make sure they come to their appointments. And then we try to be as understanding as we can when they do have relapses or lapses and try to keep them on the right track towards their sobriety in the long run. So we have both of these kind of things going on at the same time. We're now working on getting more behavioral health into our clinic to then make it a little bit easier for some of these patients who also have, you know, the co-occurring mental health diagnoses, and then having another coordinator who can work with our nurse to help coordinate these patients through the system, especially when treatment is needed.
Anything else?
Another big thing with the program, both with our Suboxone program and with just the controlled substance care team, is the interaction with the full task force, but primarily, again, our law enforcement. Law enforcement, they can tell us whatever they want. We obviously can't say much to them, but we get a lot of help with them calling us, letting us know if prescriptions are showing up at crime scenes that they're not belonging to the patients, if our Suboxone patients are misusing their medications. So we're able to kind of focus on certain patients based on what we hear from law enforcement as well.
Yeah. And maybe what I'll do is that's a very general outline of kind of what we do. I mean, I think we could probably talk for about 4 hours on what goes on day to day. For us, doing family practice, this is something that we deal with all day long, despite the fact it's a relatively small number of our patients. And we get information and we get phone calls, and we're constantly monitoring patients as we see them. Our controlled substance team meets once a week. And all of these patients, as they come into our program, when we sit down as a group with our nurses, our pharmacists, our social worker, our administration, and our doctors, sit down, and generally probably every week we go through three or four new patients that have either been referred to us or that we have found through drug refills that are not yet known to our program. Sometimes people surface because they suddenly cause a ruckus in a pharmacy, and or maybe they are calling the nurse and begging for pills, or they're going to the emergency room too much. There's just a lot of ways that you can kind of go to the front of our list. And basically we sit down and we go through that patient point by point, review their scans, review all their workup, and then we formulate a plan for that patient and recommendations that we give to the patient's primary doctor. Sometimes the nurse will take that to the physician, depending on if it's a physician that is more easily convinced that they need to make some changes with the patient. A number of times it's the physicians on the team that will have to go and sit down and discuss the patient with their doctor so that we can appropriately manage them, and we can potentially, if we need to do other workup or do other things to tell us whether or not this patient truly needs to be on narcotics or whether they might be a patient that could be brought down into a lower dose range.
We get asked a lot how patients, you know, get into this program, and you know, ultimately every patient who's on chronic narcotics in our clinic will eventually have a care plan and eventually be managed. But again, the red flag things that patients do get them to the top of the list. One big thing that really works well in our clinic is that pretty much everything goes through our controlled substance care team nurse. All the narcotic refills that come into our clinic, well, most of the time, if she's here, they do go through her, so she's able to track trends and patterns and notice things like urine drug screens and contracts, whether they're up to date or not. And that's a big thing with the entire program, why it's successful, is that even just getting the care plan signed as a physician, we don't have to go through that with the patient. I mean, you talk about it, but ultimately the nurse or the social worker comes in and takes that off the physician's plate and all that time.
Yeah. So let me just run through some of the different things we've learned, because I think for a lot of people, it's nice to learn, and some of the things that have happened as a result of our program. Number one, I think that what we have seen over this last year and a half is that because how closely we watch these people, our emergency room is a lot less busy, and our nurses are a lot less busy. The clinics that are in our area have one nurse that typically is handling all of the drug refills all day long, and a lot of these are narcotics that cause them a lot of stress. We do not get those phone calls anymore. And it is rare that we get phone calls about lost pills, stolen pills, or other problems, because patients understand that when they've signed that care plan, that we enforce it, and that they do not get early refills, and these things just don't occur. They also know that when they've signed that care plan, that going to the emergency room, they're not going to get narcotics. And previously, when we did not have this in place, one of our top diagnoses really for going to the emergency room was just to get narcotic refills and pain med refills. It is now not in the top 20. And so it's changed that a lot. I think that, you know, we've seen through our pharmacies that we have less narcotics going through, and although it really is a difficult number to follow, because not all of the pharmacies participate, and the ones that do, not all their prescriptions come from our clinic. But we know that overall, you know, typically since we have started this, we roughly have dropped the narcotic pills coming out of our main pharmacy by about 5,000 or 6,000 pills per month, from the low 40,000 range, I believe it's about 42,000, down into the 35,000 or 36,000 pill range. And of course, we're hoping that as time goes, that gets less and less. Some of the things that we've learned about patients that come to our clinic for narcotics are interesting. And number one is, one of the first things that drew our attention was patients that were driving by other clinics and coming to our clinic for pain medication. And I think just like all clinics, it is not uncommon to have a small number of the physicians doing a large number of the chronic pain patients, and that was certainly true in our clinic. Every patient that we have dealt with so far that has been driving more than 30 or 40 miles to our clinic has failed their urine drug screens or had something else come up that would make us think there was a big problem. We had patients driving over 100 miles to come to our clinic to see certain doctors. And unfortunately, we still have one of those people left that we're relatively sure is a problem. But again, you have to be sure that when you evaluate these patients, that you give them the benefit of the doubt. And thus far, this person is still seeing his physician here. I think that what we've also learned is that patients can do just about anything to fool you. And one of the biggest things is their urine. Getting urine tests is not a simple thing. Patients can crush things and put in their urine. Patients will bring in somebody else's urine. Patients can buy urine that is certified, if you will, to have a particular medication in it. We have had some of our heroin addicted patients tell us that they can go to a head shop and buy urine exactly with what they need in it. And they have very tricky ways of getting that in the urine cup. We frequently have patients that we are suspicious of, and randomly we have patients watched when they are urinating to make sure that we are getting their urine. We've had just about every interesting thing done to try and fool us, and I'm sure we are being fooled, but we continue to really watch that really very carefully. Other things that we've learned.
Those are a big, important to-dos, I guess, and learning points. We also get asked a lot how we're going to sustain this into the future, because we were lucky enough to have gotten that grant that started this this program in the first place, that SIM grant. We've been doing a lot of reaching out to state and Senate and House appropriations to get funding, which then hopefully we can help spread to other communities, trying to use the patient-centered medical home model to get to use billable services through that, working on getting a behavioral health home as another branch of our medical home to try to be able to do billable things through that, and then just a relationship with South Country and our Medicaid provider, trying to show that, you know, we are causing some savings somewhere, to try to see if that can help be a way to help pay for some of this.
And I think that really the interesting part of this, you know, as a part of our outreach, and we've gone to many of the communities around us, and I think it's really interesting to me how most of them do not think that they have much of a problem. And I think that was for us going into this, by the time we were in a month or two, I think we were so stunned by what we were finding. We were so stunned by what people were trying to do to get around us. And I think that as the year and a half has gone by, we are almost never surprised now. I mean, the level to which people will go to try and get the medications they either just want to take or want to sell, I think is really quite impressive sometimes. And so as we look at the clinics around us, I think that the problem really is until you really dig into this problem, you just never really have an idea of how horribly bad it is. Because it's much worse than we ever thought. I think that we thought that we would have this very well under control in a year and a half, and frankly, we're just scratching the surface. We've had a lot of meetings with different people at the state level about this, and I think that that's the scary part for us, is that we know that everybody around us has just as bad, if not worse, a problem than we do, and yet thus far not much has been done. And when you look at the fact that now narcotic deaths are just as high as what the deaths are in car accidents, I think that there's probably at some point money needs to be appropriated to really help solve this problem. And it can't be a problem solved by just a couple of people. It needs to be solved by really the whole state and the whole nation. You know, we didn't even touch on some of the other issues with benzodiazepines, which we are just starting to kind of work on here as well. And it's just a whole other can of worms, especially when you look at the patients that are typically on both of these medications. If you look at the data for deaths and the fact that half the narcotic deaths also involve benzodiazepines because of the respiratory depression, I think you really can't look at the one without really looking at the other over the long term. And so that's something now that we're also doing the care plan for, and we're watching, and we're doing the best we can to have physicians look at that and almost make people choose which one they feel like they need to get rid of right away, which really, you know, kind of moves into the big part of what we've learned. And the big part is that I don't think that you're going to be able to legislate change. And we had this discussion with the Attorney General yesterday in Minnesota when we were in the Twin Cities, and I think that part of the issue is that if you cannot change the physician culture of prescribing narcotics for people's pain, and you cannot, that you're just not going to be able to solve this problem. This is not a problem that I believe is going to be solved in a week or a month or a year. This is a problem that's going to take the next 5 to 10 years to get under control. And I think that it's not about as much legislation as it is changing the physician attitude and the culture and how they look at prescribing medications for pain. And I think that's a much harder thing to do. We've seen the state come out with guidelines and suggestions on how to treat these patients, and I think for the most part, people thus far have not really done much to change because of those. And I think that it takes a group like this to really help the physicians make that culture change in the long run. So I'm not sure if we want to open it up to questions or if there's other things that you would like us to cover. I think that'd be we'd be happy to answer any questions or cover some other more specific issues about our program.
So, and Rebecca, before you do open it up for questions, there is slide 17 is a nice summary of the important to-dos, the things that if those practices that want to begin to make some changes, so these are some of the core things that you'll want to be considering as you do that. So that will be a nice slide of future. And then with that, thank you. We would be happy to open up for some questions and dialogue from the group.
Well, to the speakers, thank you so much. Rhonda, Kurt, Heather, thank you so incredibly much for your, first of all, for your dedication to your own community and the patients that you serve. We all know, those of us on the phone and in the field, that these individuals are often not the easiest to work with and can be incredibly challenging. People don't always get the sort of warm vibes that you may get when you send your checks into St. Jude Children's Hospital, but still these individuals need our care, our support, our attention, and our treatment. And thank you for your willingness to engage with such a complex issue and for your continued work. And may I bring you good wishes. I hope that all of your creative ways of sustaining this funding may continue, and let's hope that perhaps some of the funding out of the CARA and 21st Century Cures legislation may come your way as well. So any last thoughts from any of you on the in the speaker room?
No, I think that's about it. And obviously, if anybody has any questions, they can sure get hold of us. I think you must have our information. If they can send us an email or something, that'd be fine.
Absolutely. So for anyone, if you think of a question after the call concludes, do not hesitate. You can send them to my address, and I'll forward them on. It's rchickey, so that's rchickey at aha.org. And for those of you who sent in questions to me earlier during the call, much appreciated, very much. And with that, we'll wrap up today's conference call.
Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. At this time, this does conclude today's teleconference. You may now disconnect.